subversion and, you know, kind of capital flight that the U.S. was encouraging at the time. China's response was to start to build a defensive perimeter around the South China Sea, in particular using, you know, missile systems and anti-access systems. And then the other response was to kind of create an overland escape route that pivoted away from the South China Sea and made it much less important, made it redundant. And that was what we call the Belt and Road Initiative, which creates this massive infrastructure and logistical pathway following the track of the ancient Silk Road across Central Asia and then into Europe and Africa.
Wow. Well, we're at a time now, but obviously we're going to have to watch this very closely. KG No, who is our longtime correspondent for the region, we're going to watch it all very closely. Please, KG, stay safe and come back soon.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's always a pleasure.
Same here. And that's it for us. Stay tuned.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, everybody. Erica from RTalk Bus Stop here. I just wanted to take a moment to thank a few folks who made the show possible this year. The young artists at ROCA, the Reynolds Art Show at Reynolds High School, their teacher Katie Sullivan, Justin Birmingham, Dana Lucero, and especially Nicole Cabrera, my current co-host, who is a graduate of Reynolds High School. She's unfortunately out sick this week. We'll be back in January with new episodes and guests, but until then, here's an episode from March where we interviewed artist Ryan Pierce. Enjoy.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop. I'm Emily from ROCA, which is Reynolds Gallery of Contemporary Art, and our guest here is Ryan Pierce.
Hi.
And I'm Miriam, the other speaker.
And we also have Erica producing. So, Ryan, what do you do? Like, what is your job?
I have two jobs. First of all, let me say thank you for inviting me to be here.
Yes.
Emily, Miriam, Erica. Yeah, I have two jobs. I'm a visual artist, and that's kind of my day job these days. And I mostly make paintings, and sometimes I make sculptures. And I have a second job, which is working for an arts organization called Signal Fire. And it's an arts organization that I co-founded 10 years ago. And we do basically camping experiences for artists of all kinds.
Can you talk more about Signal Fire?
Oh, yeah. I could talk, you know, for our entire allotted time, so you'll have to stop me or steer me. But basically, I co-founded it with my partner, Amy Harwood, and she's a public lands activist, and her history is all around Mount Hood. And so she's coming from a public lands advocacy community, and I'm coming from the art world. And we wanted to kind of get our friends to hang out together and get artists to go camping with us and teach them how to go backpacking and make it feel accessible and fun to be outside and see how that would inspire their work. And in doing so, we thought maybe we could kind of like get them to fall in love with these places that we cared about so much. and get them to advocate for those places through their artwork. So the idea behind the project is basically that artists have a really unique ability to like create political change and cultural change, and that if we bring them into wild places, they're going to care about those places and start making work about that.
So what was your biggest art accomplishment that you've had so far in your career?
Biggest accomplishment? You know, I think for me, there's not a like a single accolade that really stands out, but every day that I work as an artist feels like the biggest accomplishment. You know, like just the feeling of getting out of bed and like all I have to do that day is go to the studio, and it's completely self-directed, and like it was many years of hard work to get to a place where that's what I get to do all day. And so it just feels totally awesome, and I never take it for granted. It's like really the best job in the world. And it, you know, that said, like I have many times had to pay the bills by doing other things, and I probably will again. I often will teach at the college level to kind of patch it together or do more work for nonprofits or speaking tours and stuff like that. But yeah, I think the biggest accomplishment for me is just like getting to live my dream of being an artist.
So I think you have an art piece in the art museum right now. Is that true? Or did you have one?
I was in a group show at the art museum last year, and then the museum purchased one of the pieces for their permanent collection, but I don't think it's hanging up yet. But keep an eye out. I think, you know, when they refresh their hanging, maybe it'll be on view.
Mm. How long does it take to like make an art piece for you?
A couple weeks longer than I think it will every time. So the piece in question is a 6-foot by 6-foot painting, and you can look at my work online. It's pretty detailed, it's pretty graphic and like labor intensive, so it takes me about a month of working 6 or 7 days a week to make a piece that large. But I also make smaller works on paper and, you know, other stuff.
When you look at your art pieces and when you're making them, what do you want the person that's looking at them to see and to feel?
Oh, such a good question. I want my work to be, let's say, open-ended enough that they can bring their own interpretation and experience to the piece. And so I don't want absolute control over what that is for them, but I do want it to be evocative. I want them to be maybe a little off balance and disoriented when they look at the work and say, like, you know, kind of like, this is exciting and visually stimulating and maybe a little confusing and paradoxical. And maybe they're like, they have questions about what it's meant to be, and they have a hunch, or maybe some multiple hunches or even conflicting hunches. And then they're sort of like, if they want to look at it for a while, that sustained viewing experience adds up to like a, maybe a story or some overlapping stories for them.
Did you grow up here? Or?
No, I grew up in Mendocino County in Northern California. I moved to Portland when I was 19 or 20. Yeah, I moved here 20 years ago because I'm older than Santa Claus. And so, yeah, I've spent my whole, I would say my whole mature life in Portland. Mm.
Did you go to college?
I did. I went to UC Santa Cruz for a year or so. And at that point, so I grew up in a pretty rural place, and I didn't have any models of professional artists. Like, that wasn't really a thing where I grew up. So it's pretty cool that you guys have this and can you know, bring in different career examples and see that this is actually a thing that people do. But where I lived, didn't really know about that. I knew I wanted to be one, but I didn't have any real examples of that. And so I tried for a couple of years to find a sensible career. And you know, my folks have always been really supportive, and they helped me go to undergrad, and they were encouraging me to pick something that would pay the bills and to do art on the side. And there was a conflict in my heart about that, because you know, some people just really can't do anything but I'm just too weird. And so I dropped out of college, and I spent a couple of years backpacking and getting really into you know, being outside and learning about wilderness skills and stuff like that. And then I moved to Portland, and you know, was around like galleries and museums and contemporary art for the first time. And I went back to school at Oregon College of Art and Craft, which is a phenomenal institution that sadly just closed last year. And then I got a graduate degree at California College of the Arts in San Francisco. So I went to a lot of school, a lot of art school. Yeah, that was a long answer to your question.
All right, so what advice would you give to someone like me who's like trying to figure out what to do? And would you think like going to an art college would be like a good idea, or not going to an art college?
I think that it's great to try out studying art. If you want to study at the college level, I started by taking some classes at Portland Community College. And one of the dirty secrets about the art education scene is that PCC pays their teachers the most. And so they have some of the best instructors. And so you can get really, really good art classes, and just get a sense of if that's what you want to like do with your time. Do you like being around that world? Because art college is so expensive. It's a little bit of a scam. And you really want to make sure that you are wanting to take on that level of commitment before committing to that whole scene. That said, once, you know, if you decide that it is right for you, like, that's really an exciting place to be, because everybody is there because they 100% want to be an artist. And so they're dressing like it, and they're talking like it, and they're, you know, it's like a really different vibe than studying at community college.
What was your first successful piece that you remember doing? Like, the first thing that you were like, yes, this is it.
Well, I remember in high school that I had a crush on a girl, and I drew her picture from a photograph and gave it to her, and she really liked it. And that was, I would say that was like really kind of why I got into the business. Yeah. And then I won like a local, I don't know, like third place in a local art show. I would say that I'm like really a slow bloomer, and I did not find early career success, and did not like win a lot of stuff. Like, you know, there's a AP art class, just like there's AP everything else. And I think I got like a 2 out of 5 or something. And that's like the writing on the wall that, you know, no kid, like this is not a promising direction. But I was just like really certain the whole time that that's what I wanted to do. And now when I look back on that work, and I'm like, oh yeah, they were right. Like, it was really bad, but I just thought it was really awesome.
How do you like advertise your work, like your paintings?
I don't do much of that. I work with a gallery that's based in Portland pretty regularly, and they, part of their job is to promote me. And so the business side of things is that when they sell my work, they get fully half the price. Part of that is that they connect collectors to my work, whether that's like a random art collector or the art museum or somebody like that, and they facilitate all those discussions. And they also are supposed to get the word out that I'm worth collecting. But I do have an Instagram account, and so I do a little bit of self-promotion, and I keep an email list, so I just like spam all my friends and acquaintances twice a year and say, here's what I'm up to. And you know, that's worth doing, because especially at the beginning of your career, the people who collect your work are family and friends and people who like know you and believe in you and see your vision.
Do you have an embarrassing story about your work?
Oh, yeah. Totally. I mean, I have a lot of them. Okay, one embarrassing story is that... this is going to be kind of a long answer. Are you ready for it? Okay. I sold a really big piece, like, when I was coming out of grad school, I made this enormous painting, and a museum on the East Coast bought it. And I was living in San Francisco, and I made the work on canvas, and I stretched it over four separate wood panels that were connected together. And the idea was that if somebody bought it and I needed to ship it, I could unstretch the canvas, take apart the wood panels, ship it all separately so that it wouldn't cost a fortune. Because to ship something that's 16 by 8 feet in a crate is just cost prohibitive. So that worked. And the museum was like, okay, we're going to put this in a show and fly you out and put you in a hotel and you'll be there at the opening. And why don't you get here a few days early and put your work back together and help us install it? Great, no problem. So I get there. But what I hadn't anticipated was that the East Coast is so much more humid than the West Coast. And so my panels had swollen and they were now a new size that was larger than the surface area of the canvas. So I put the panels back together and I didn't have a check for the paintings yet, you know, like, and the collector was sort of like standing over me, watching me put it together. And when I went to put the painting onto the panels, it was like an inch too short on every side. And so there was just like a band of white unpainted canvas, like all around the edge of the painting. And so I was like, you know, pouring sweat in this like hot East Coast summer, like with really bad tools, didn't know anybody. And they're just kind of like pacing around waiting for the grand unveiling. And I was like, oh. And so I dragged over this intern and I was like, you gotta help me. I told him what was going on. And we put a big quilt down on the ground and we laid the painting on its face. And then we just sat there and tugged so hard on the canvas that we stretched it back into shape. And at any moment I felt like it was gonna tear in half and I would lose, you know, the entire paycheck. That was embarrassing, but it worked.
At least it ended up working in the end.
I know, yeah. There are probably some other embarrassing oh yeah, they're all coming back now. We could do a whole podcast about that.
Do you have any stories about Signal Fire?
Yeah, oh yeah. So we've had 450 artists come through Signal Fire and we're 10 years in now. And so we have a ton of stories. And people always want to hear the crazy stories, you know, because we do backpacking trips. And so people are like, you know, what happens if people like fall down the mountain? You know, they want to hear like something tragic. And we don't have any tragic stories, fortunately, knock wood. And we all our guides are trained in wilderness first aid. And we, you know, have really good logistical plans for emergencies and stuff. But one of the stories that... I think about as just kind of like a crazy day was we had been out backpacking in Northern California along the Smith River and really beautiful week. It was the first week of a month-long trip. And when we do these month-long trips, we resupply every week and go get more groceries and do our laundry and call our family and stuff. And so we'll have a couple days back in town and staying at a campground. And then we go back into the wilderness. And when we came back to the cars, we had a van and an SUV support car. And the van had a flat tire. And the support car had a cracked windshield. Well, there was nobody else at the trailhead. And we were like, oh no, what happened? You know. And so we started looking around. And I noticed that there were bear prints up the hood of my car. It had walked across the windshield and across the top of the car. And then we think it had gone over to the van and checked that out and stood on the back tire and popped it with its, you know, claw and then maybe got scared and ran away after that. And so we solved that part of the mystery, but then we were like, I don't know, 20 miles out of dirt road. That was another 20 miles from the tiniest town, which was just like a gas station. And So luckily the SUV was still working, and I drove into town. I left our whole group and my co-guide back at the trailhead. And it took me about an hour to get to the gas station, and I called a tow truck, and he gets out to pick me up at the gas station to meet me there, and I tell him where the van is, and he's like, oh, no way, I'm not going down that road. I'll never get out. And I was like, please, you got to help me. And I just, like, begged and pleaded, and he's like, fine. So we get out there. He gets down. First, we tried to switch out the tire on the van, but the flat wasn't like the lugs weren't in the right place because it was a new van. And then he was like, well, even if I put the van on top of my truck, like the hill's too steep, my brakes will fail and we'll all just like plunge off a cliff. And I was like, okay, that's not good. And he said, you know, plus it's going to be so tall, it's going to like be hitting the tree branches and stuff. And so our whole crew is hanging around, and this tow truck driver is about to leave us stranded, and they just started like pleading with him, and then he got really inspired and started feeling heroic, and he's like, well, I didn't come out here to fail. And so we put the van up there, and I rode in the passenger seat of the van and like on top of the tow truck, and to hold the tree branches out of the way as we got out there. And then we got out to the hill, and we would just drive like 40 feet, pull over, let the brakes cool, go another 40 feet. So it took us like 3 hours to get back to town. But this guy was so cool. And then he like woke his friend up. It's like nighttime. We've been awake for ever. Everyone's so hungry and so excited to get back to town and get like a hot meal. And he gets his friend up and makes us a tire, like makes us a rim for our tire from scratch with his metal shop, and puts it on the van, gets us out of there. And then my co-instructor had a migraine, so she's just like completely comatose in the seat of the support car. So one of the students was driving for us, and we get into the campground at like 2 a.m. and made dinner together, and it was really awesome. Can I ask you guys questions too?
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite artists that you've been looking at, or works that you found inspirational lately?
I follow a lot of tattoo artists in Portland on on Instagram, because like their art is just like, I love it, and I'd love to get tattooed by them. Mm-hmm. I follow a lot of tattoo artists for sure.
Who are the tattoo artists I should check out?
I think one of them is called like Shannon Wolf. I think she owns a tattoo like studio, and then I also follow another artist that works in that studio. And they have like beautiful art.
It's like is it like a lot of color?
I think Shannon does, she'll do like lines and then a pop of color, and she'll take like a photograph and then like tattoo it simplified. And this other one, she does like nice leafy and like flower art. It's really pretty.
Cool. What about you, Miriam?
I'm not like into any tattoo artists, but I'm into like sketches, drawings, just like simple things that you could like make it bigger and stuff. And like I go on Instagram, like I spend my time on there like 24/7, and I'm just looking at artists, like no one specific, but all these art pieces, like they all have different tastes and everything, and I take from their what they're doing and I put it into what I'm doing, and pretty much I take what they do and put it into my own work.
Yeah.
Kind of like, not forgery, but...
No, inspiration.
Yeah, they're inspiring me to do my own thing, so...
Yeah, that's how we all get started.
Yeah.
Were you two aware of the banana taped to the wall scandal last week?
Yes, I know about it.
Have you had some discussion in your class about that at all?
No one's talked about it.
I think just for posterity, maybe we should remind everybody what that is, like what happened.
Yeah, so
somebody want to summarize really quick?
Do you want to do it, Emily?
I mean, I don't know the details, but...
Well, so this artist, Maurizio Catalan, is like a pretty internationally well-known, kind of a prankster artist. He's sort of known for doing ridiculous pieces of work. Like he had a piece, like a photorealistic sculpture of the Pope crushed by a meteorite.
Oh.
but last week was Art Basel, in Miami, which is a really big international art fair, and it's really overpriced and ridiculous and lots of parties and, you know, Jay-Z running around spending money. And a French gallery showed a piece by this artist, Maurizio Catalan, that was a banana duct taped to a wall. And it was $120,000. It was an edition of three.
What?
And it sold out right away. That's and crazy. It was not like a wooden banana or a, you know, it's just like an actual banana taped to a wall.
Literally. Wow. And,
you know, so people were outraged because, like, how ridiculous is that? And then somebody came and ate the banana as a performance. And this was not part of the plan. And so they replaced it with a new banana. And then somebody defaced the wall. So, and then it was getting so popular with people taking selfies and stuff that they took it down. And then the gallery owner ate the banana.
Yeah, there's video of the guy taking it off the wall, eating it, and then being escorted out. And I was like, what?
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. I think it's kind of like the art world is crazy because, like, it can literally be anything. Because, like, it's like reminds me of Banksy a little bit. Like, like his art, like, open-minded kind of things. And the bananas is, like, funny. Because, like, you literally just took a banana probably from your living room or put it on a wall, sold it for lots of money,
and
someone just ate it.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Asia Martinez, and all bananas aside, I see that you really enjoy painting various types of plants, whether that be vines or flowers, or at least they're usually incorporated based on the portfolios you've put together on your website. One of my favorite pieces of yours is the terminal degree, along with the shape of the beast. However, my question for you is, what type of artist would you consider yourself? A surrealist?
Oh, that's right on point. I would consider myself a post-surrealist because I identify the movement of surrealism as like kind of a fixed movement that happened during like World War One and Two, you know, mostly centralized in Europe and somewhat in the U.S. and with sort of like other movements that trickle out responding to that afterwards. And so actual surrealism is over, but I totally am influenced by that style. And those were all the artists that I was really excited about, you know, coming up and learning to draw and stuff, especially an artist named Max Ernst. You know, Max Ernst, I can see from your smile. So yeah, and his wife when they were alive was Dorothea Tanning, and her work is really phenomenal as well. So yeah, completely inspired by surrealism, and I integrate a lot of those techniques into my work. And part of that is conceptual as well, because the surrealists were responding to sort of a time of overwhelming hopelessness and the rise of fascism, and just, you know, come after World War One, just this colossal amount of violence and, you know, like a third of the male population of Europe died. And they were responding with, you know, starting with the Dada movement, with nonsense and saying the world is nonsensical. And so we need to reach into our dream worlds and to look for meaning there. And I feel like, you know, my work is about climate change and the weird world that we're moving into, or, you know, it's the same world, but it's becoming weirder and less recognizable. And I feel like some of the same strategies of looking to the sort of dreamlike imagery and unexpected solutions might be a more sensible place to go when the world of sense making is run by, again, the rise of fascism and, you know, neocons and stuff like that.
Well, I really respect that, for lack of a better word.
Thanks.
Another question I have is, what inspires the name for your art, such as the Seal of Strength and Solitude?
Yeah, so the piece that you're referring to is part of an artist book that I did. And I do sort of like conventional gallery shows regularly, but I always like to have an element of a giveaway or something interactive. Especially as my work gets more expensive, I like to have work that's free for my friends. Because, I mean, going back to the banana, it's like one of the fun things about the art world, fun and like kind of disturbing, is that the value of art is so just random. And it's just based on like chance and investment and whim and reputation. And so it's fun to show work that's expensive and free right next to each other, and to think that anybody could have access to it. So the piece that you're talking about was part of a book, and it's an illustrated book, but the illustrations were made separately from the text. And so if you got a book, they were $15, and you got just the text, and you got a list of clues. And if you follow the clues, you go around the whole Portland metro area to places where rivers come together, to different confluences, and you could dig up the illustrations for the book out of the ground and add them to your book to complete the text. So it was like kind of a treasure hunt, and I've done a few projects like that. Like one time I had just blank panels in the gallery, and people could go out to these different wild areas and dig up the real paintings out of the ground and bring them back to the gallery. And if they found one, they got to keep it for free after the show was over. So that's one of those projects. And so the seal of the strength in solitude, or whatever I called it, that was all of the illustrations in that book, all those pieces were sort of along this theme of like ecological passport, like doing all these different things to sort of like live right in the climate change future.